This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, a special pre-recorded program while VOA headquarters resolves some technical issues. I'm your host, Yehia Suhib, in Washington. Coming up.
The situation in Africa is even more worrying than elsewhere. But on other sides, there could be some factors that will make it maybe less dramatic than what is happening today in some countries.
That was Pierre Mindy Hart, Deputy Director of Operations for Humanitarian Group Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders, on Africa's prospects as the coronavirus spreads. Details coming up. Also, Boko Haram militants kill 92 Chadian soldiers and wound 47 more. We'll have these stories and more next in this special VOA Africa program. Our top story, a growing number of African nations are imposing strict measures to battle a still small but spreading outbreak of coronavirus across the continent. Some fear Africa may be a perfect storm when it comes to the virus, but experts say it also has some key strengths against the disease. For VOA, Lisa Bryant reports from Paris.
South Africa, Senegal, and Ivory Coast are among the latest African countries to announce new steps to contain COVID-19, including threats of heavy fines for violators.
Je déclare l'état d'urgence.
Ivorian President Alassane Ouattara declared a state of emergency on Monday and tightened restrictions, including imposing a dusk-to-dawn curfew.
Je déclare l'état d'urgence sur l'ensemble du territoire national.
The same message from Senegal's President Macky Sall. Both leaders have also earmarked funds to help their populations and health workers battle the virus. Coronavirus cases have been reported in more than 40 African countries to date, with South Africa the hardest hit. The numbers are still a fraction of those in Asia, Europe, or the United States, but experts fear that could change. Fragile health systems, poverty, population density in big cities, and insecurity could turn a major health problem into a catastrophe. Last week, World Health Organization Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus warned the continent must wake up to the coronavirus threat.
So the best advice for Africa is to prepare for the worst and prepare today.
The situation in Africa is even more worrying than elsewhere. But on other sides, there could be some factors that will make it maybe less dramatic than what is happening today in some countries.
Pierre Mendiarat is Deputy Director of Operations for humanitarian group Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders. He says one of Africa's advantages is timing. The region is behind other places like China or Italy on the coronavirus trajectory.
Even in the worst-case scenario, the peak will arrive later, and therefore maybe there will be more resources.
Which means African nations might be able to tap health supplies, like masks and oxygen machines, from countries where the pandemic has subsided, and take advantage of possible research advances, like rapid testing and experimental treatments. African nations that weathered the Ebola outbreak might have an extra advantage, although experts note COVID-19 is far more contagious.
I think there the health authorities have learned a lot about the strategy against an epidemic, and the population has also learned a lot, and there are some common practicalities to fight against both diseases. For example, the hand washing.
So tough measures to slow coronavirus and to buy time to better fight it may be the best strategy for Africa right now. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Dr. Ahmed Ogwell, the Deputy Director of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, says the continent has learned lessons from the Ebola outbreak and is better prepared to respond to the coronavirus. Ogwell recently spoke with VOA Salem Salomon.
Indeed, Africa has learned from the Ebola outbreak of 2014-2016. And that is why when this particular outbreak started, Africa CDC is present. This is one lesson learned. During the Ebola outbreak of 2014, there was no Africa CDC, but the heads of state found it wise to be able to establish a continental specialized agency to address these emergency preparedness and response. So that is one. Secondly is a cross-border collaboration. This has been a very big lesson during the Ebola time, and we are using it quite effectively now during this COVID-19 outbreak, so that countries are coming together and utilizing resources in one country to help the other country. And that way, each country does not have to have the full set of resources that are required to be able to address the outbreak, like laboratories, experts, and other experiences that come into play to address the outbreak. Third is that during the Ebola outbreak, the policy side was a bit slow to respond. And we've learned from that. And during this outbreak, health ministers came together very quickly and provided guidance that we as technical agency are using to be able to build the capacity and support countries on the continent. And finally, we also learned during the Ebola outbreak that we needed very close coordination with partners. And during this COVID-19 outbreak, we have mobilized partners from the very beginning, and we are working very closely with the various partners on the continent and beyond to ensure that we don't have a very large number of cases on the continent. So we've learned a lot from Ebola, and we are using those lessons to improve the way we respond this time around.
That was Dr. Ahmed Ogwell, Deputy Director of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, speaking with VOA Salem Salamone. Egyptian Prime Minister Mustafa Madbouly has announced stricter curfew measures to help combat the further spread of the coronavirus, ordering all non-essential government agencies to close, prohibiting vehicles from public roads during the 7 p.m. to 6 a.m. curfew, closing businesses other than bakeries and pharmacies, and extending the closure of schools for 2 weeks. Edward Yerenian reports from Cairo.
As people took to the streets of Egypt's historic port city of Alexandria to beg for God's mercy, the government took strict measures to help halt the spread of the coronavirus. Prime Minister Mustafa Madbouly announced the measures in a televised address. He says the government is trying to save people's lives and will impose a curfew from 7 p.m. to 6 a.m., halting all public and private transportation and closing all stores and businesses overnight. He says the curfew will last 15 days. He says the government is trying to save people's lives and will impose a curfew from 7 p.m. to 6 a.m., halting all public and private transportation and closing all stores and businesses overnight. He says the curfew will last 15 days. Madbouly warned that even stricter measures could be enacted if the situation worsens, and he said it is imperative to act now to save as many lives as possible. Health Minister Hala Zayed warned the situation is serious and the government is concerned things could get worse, although the situation currently remains under control. She says Egypt could surpass more than 1,000 cases of the coronavirus and is in its sixth week of fighting the disease. Zayed says the country is averaging about 30 new cases daily, with one recent spike above 40. Egypt is now on level 3 of the World Health Organization's 4-level contagion scale, with cases clustered in certain parts of the country, but no spread of the disease to the general population so far, she said. Zayed also warned that 65 of the country's reported coronavirus cases were asymptomatic and that these individuals showed no visible sign of being ill, even though they were contagious to others.
Egyptian media showed public health workers spraying disinfectant in trains, public buses, and on handrails and turnstiles. Trucks also sprayed disinfectant with chlorine in streets and public squares as workers doused businesses and stalls in public markets. Egyptian TV showed workers disinfecting display cases at Egypt's iconic museum in the center of Cairo, including glass enclosures for iconic antiquities like King Tut's golden mask. Hotels and resort towns, including Sharm el-Sheikh and Hurghada, also have been closed and are being disinfected. Airports have been shut down until month's end, and most foreign tourists have left the country. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
You are listening to a special recorded program on VOA Africa. I'm your host, Yehei Swuhib. Here is a recap of our top stories. Egypt has announced stricter curfew measures to help combat COVID-19. And the deputy director of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the continent is better prepared to respond to the coronavirus. VOA is experiencing some technical difficulties, so we are offering this program recorded earlier. We aim to return to our normal programming within a few days. And in the meantime, thanks for listening to Africa News Tonight. And for more news and information, visit our website at voanews.com. As social distancing measures to combat the spread of the novel coronavirus tighten across Africa, people who depend on casual employment are finding it harder to earn a living. Many who live urban slums are having trouble buying food and paying rent, let alone buying products like disinfectants and soap to protect against the virus. As April Zhu reports from Nairobi, some grassroots organizations are taking relief efforts into their own hands and not waiting for the state to help.
Long before the coronavirus outbreak, Kate Wanjiru knew every single person who is disabled, chronically ill, or receiving treatment for an infectious disease within one small area of Mathare, one of Nairobi's slums. She is one of 1,000 community health workers who have been working in Mathare for years. Wanjiru checks in on people who live within her designated cluster, making sure they have enough medication, referring them to a hospital, or reporting them if they stop taking medication for an infectious disease that put the surrounding community at risk. So when the Kenyan government issued social distancing directives that told Kenyans to stay home to contain the spread of COVID-19, she knew exactly which households would be losing income and run out of cash within days.
We were like telling them, you need to stay at home. And they were like, give us the food and then we'll be in our houses. Pay for us our rent and then you won't see us outside.
Wanjiru is also a lead researcher at the Ghetto Foundation, a community-based organization in Mathare. The group has been collecting donations and sending 2,000 Kenyan shillings, about $20, via mobile money to each household so that they can purchase food and soap. On Sunday, Kenya's Ministry of Health confirmed 8 more cases of COVID-19, bringing the total count to 15. In a public address, Cabinet Secretary Mutahi Kagwe stressed the importance of Kenyans adhering to restrictions, which now include a total ban on international flights into Kenya starting Wednesday, suspension of all religious gatherings, and limiting restaurants to takeaway services only.
As I cautioned last week, this disease is not a joke. Kenyans must treat this matter with the seriousness it deserves by adjusting and changing their lifestyles.
But Suhail Omar, a Kenyan organizer who was initiating similar mutual aid efforts in Nairobi, says that many Kenyans who depend on casual employment in the informal sector are continuing to work, not out of carelessness, but necessity.
If you tell someone who gets less than a dollar per day to stay home and do nothing, for them that's like a joke. For them that's like something they can't do.
Omar partnered with Wevin Muganda to set up mutual aid initiatives in Nairobi and Mombasa, respectively. They spoke with community organizers to identify which households were at greatest risk and purchase flour, beans, and soap in bulk. Instead of waiting for COVID-19 aid from the government or foreign organizations, Omar and Muganda decided it was up to Kenyans to assist Kenyans.
Why we took the route of mutual aid is because we believe that community is all we have. We believe that when people get together to meet each other's basic survival needs with a shared understanding of what the system we live in under, like right now is, we can do it together and we can do it right now. We don't have to wait on anyone.
Still, there are steps that the Kenyan government can take immediately to provide relief to Nairobi's most vulnerable, says Irungu Houghton, executive director at Amnesty International Kenya.
There is a recognition that the coronavirus is not just an epidemic or a pandemic of public health concern, but actually it is a triple crisis. It's a crisis of our public health care systems. It's a crisis of water supply and also food provision.
Amnesty International Kenya was among 16 Kenyan and international organizations that co-signed a letter on March 21st demanding that the Kenyan government, in light of an impending COVID-19 outbreak, take measures to give those living in urban informal settlements access to water. The organizations called for a temporary moratorium on water and electricity charges in slums, the provision of water in communities that are currently not serviced, and lifting the ban on rainwater harvesting. April Ju for VOA News, Nairobi.
The defense minister of Sudan, General Jamaldeen Omar, has died after a sudden heart attack in South Sudan. Reuters reports he died while he was taking part in peace negotiations between the government and armed movements in Juba. Omar was a member of the military council that took power after toppling President Omar al-Bashir last year and replaced it with the Sovereign Council, which runs the country under a 39-month power-sharing deal with the civilian government. Since October, Sudan's transitional government has been locked in talks with rebel groups that fought Bashir's regime in the vast western region of Darfur and in the southern border states of Blue Nile and South Kordofan. Just last Monday, General Omar said he was confident that the two sides would sign a deal to form a national army. Chad's president Idriss Deby says Boko Haram militants killed 92 soldiers and wounded 47 more in the deadliest attack ever on the country's military. Reuters reports the attack occurred on Monday in the west of the country, where the armies of Chad, Nigeria, and Niger have been fighting the Islamist militants for years. Footage of state TV showed the president, who has ruled Chad since 1990 and survived several rebellions and coup attempts, walking among the charred remains of burned-out vehicles. Boko Haram has stepped up its attack in recent months on the islands of the Lake Chad Basin, where the group takes advantage of the vast terrain to launch assaults. The Boko Haram insurgency, which erupted in northeast Nigeria in 2009, has killed more than 30,000 people and forced the displacement of about 2 million. The charity Oxfam says climate change is driving gender-based violence among rural communities in the breakaway region of Somaliland. In times of increasing drought, women travel further to find water and other needs, raising the risk of sexual violence. Similarly, men, unable to support their families too often, take out their frustrations on their family. Neha Wadikar visited the region of Sul, Somaliland, with Oxfam and has this report.
35-year-old Fatima, who for privacy did not want to use her family name, says her family lost all their livestock to drought. After moving with her husband and children closer to town to find work, Fatima's husband abandoned her and filed for divorce, but not before assaulting her. She says her husband physically abused her several times, hitting her and threatening to choke her with a rope. Fatima now lives in a camp for displaced people on the outskirts of Hargeisa, the capital of Somaliland. She supports her children through a small tea shop, earning about $40 per month, barely enough to feed themselves. The Oxfam Gender Protection Coordinator in Somaliland, Abdi Rashid Yusuf, says women displaced by climate change, like Fatima, are at high risk for sexual and gender-based violence, SGBV.
Risks include they are more exposed on SGBV issues like rape and sexual exploitation is on that. They had limited knowledge about to cope the situation.
On the outskirts of the town of Oug, Ibado Mohamed Abdullah is working to prevent violence against displaced women. She oversees three displacement camps. To improve women's safety in the camp, Abdullah created women's associations that provide counseling for those assaulted and take criminal cases to the authorities. She says if a girl who was raped came to her, she would immediately take her to the hospital for care and then to the police station to try to help identify and arrest the perpetrator. Women in the camps take precautions. They travel in groups to collect firewood and water and make sure one woman keeps watch while the others sleep. But as climate change intensifies in this region, the number of displaced women at risk of violence will only get worse. Neha Wadekar for VOA News, Seoul Region, Somaliland.
America says sanctions alone may not be enough to push Zimbabwe's government to uphold and respect human rights. Rutendo Maweri reports from Harare.
U.S. Assistant Secretary for the Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights and Labor, Robert Destro, recently told reporters it is the responsibility of Zimbabwe and its citizens to ensure there are no human rights violations.
No, sanctioning is not enough. At the end of the day, the responsibility to police the boundaries of human rights rests with the Zimbabwean people themselves. And we respect their sovereignty. Our job is to be to call the situation as we see it and to offer whatever assistance we can that is that's consistent with a healthy, vibrant bilateral relationship.
The report states that significant human rights violations in Zimbabwe included arbitrary killings and torture by security forces, harsh and life-threatening prison conditions, political prisoners, invasion of privacy, serious problems with the independence of the judiciary, and the worst forms of government repression of free expression, press, and the internet. The report also notes substantial interference with the rights of peaceful and free assembly, restrictions on political participation, widespread and abuse of women and girls. The report also says impunity remains a problem, with the government allegedly taking very few steps to identify or investigate officials who committed human rights abuses. Destro said he could not disclose whether a Washington, D.C.-based firm, Ballard Partners, hired by the Zimbabwe government to lobby the U.S. government on its behalf for the removal of sanctions, has already engaged the U.S. government.
I cannot speak to the question about whether or not Ballard Partners has been involved. In fact, it's actually the Treasury Department, not the State Department, that imposes the sanctions. But I do think that one of the things that comes out in the Zimbabwe sanctions is that it's possible to get them lifted.
Zimbabwe is reported to be paying $500,000 a year to the firm, despite the country's economic crisis. On Wednesday, the U.S. Treasury Department cited involvement in human rights abuses for adding two officials to the sanctions list. Destro said the purpose of the human rights report was to foster peace and security and to ensure that member states adhere to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
We know that when governments respect human rights and fundamental freedoms, democratic institutions and the rule of law are more stable and secure.
In the report, America monitors the human rights record of all countries that it gives assistance. For VOA, this is Rutendo Mawere in Harare.
And that wraps up this special VOA Africa program. I'm Yeyis Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com.